And welcome back to Gillespie. I am your host, Josh Gillespie. We are here on FTRradio.com. For those of you who have stuck with us through all the repeats and the best ofs, I thank you for sticking around. Tonight we're back with a brand new original show. With me, as always, is my co-host, Christy Kelly. You can find her at ChristyKelly.com as well as at HoosierAccess.com. We hope to have Mark Warner on in a little bit. He's doing some campaign stuff today, but he was with me as well as April Gregory and Hostage Hoosier, also known as Emily Borkholder, at the Smart Girls Summit. We hope to have a summit wrap-up, even though it was a couple weeks ago, but we hope to have a wrap-up of that event. And then we will also be hoping to speak with Jason, is it Christy? Jason Ziegler. John, my bad. Oh, I should know the name of our guests. John Ziegler. You can find it at johnziegler.com. He's leading the path to bring the documentary, The Path to 9/11, back to the television and into DVD production. This is something that has been suppressed. And before you go on thinking that it's some truth or conspiracy, this isn't. This actually is a very good documentary that was produced by ABC / Disney, and they have refused to allow its reproduction since its original airing. But we will be speaking with John Ziegler. And of course, I forgot to mention the man who makes the show run, the man who makes the show sound great, Mike Jazerski. Mike, thanks for being with us. He's been the one who's also been putting up the repeats, so I thank him for all his hard work, even when we've been on sort of a busy schedule. But I want to talk to you guys about poor Barack Obama. On election night 2008, then-President-elect Obama walked out into a huge stage in Chicago's Grant Park to rapturous applause, announcing the arrival of a new savior. He was the man who was going to heal the earth, befriend the Muslims, repair all racial divisions, and even fix the economy. And all of this before lunch. October 2010 has arrived, and Barack Obama is a colossal failure. A failure of epic proportions. One that Homer, author of the epic poems The Iliad and the Odyssey, and not Homer Simpson, could easily write volumes and volumes of tales about. A failure to such a degree that not only does Jimmy Carter appear to be a strong executive in comparison, a recent poll showed President Obama in a virtual tie with former President George W. Bush, who the liberal media will have you believe is still fairly unpopular. All hyperbole aside, I take no pride in saying these words. I'm not a gleeful partisan who's happily piling on to the incomparable failure who happens to be from another party. I say this as a proud American, one who is both enormously proud of his country while remaining deeply concerned for her future. These are dark days for our nation, and while the American people are staring into the abyss, they'd like to be able to take comfort in knowing that the man who is leading them is capable of shutting the door and helping to turn things towards a brighter future. Barack Obama is entirely incapable of being that man. Sitting in the grand office inside the White House's West Wing must be a thoroughly humbling experience. To be in that chair and know that you are the most powerful man who has ever lived is something none of us has any understanding of. The ability to make a single phone call and bomb an entire civilization out of existence provides a level of power that men will literally sell their souls to experience, and the graveyard of American politics is littered with the headstones of many men who've done so. Barack Obama appears to be a man who is in love with having that kind of power, as well as basking in the glow of adoration that accompanied his stunning rise to power. Here's a man who wrote not one, but two memoirs before his mid-40s, and before actually accomplishing a single thing of note beyond writing those memoirs. It's as if someone actually sat down to write a book describing to the world just how amazing that person is, and that's precisely what Obama has done. Even worse is that tens of millions of people who look to him as the man who would lead them out of the darkness and into their own version of a promised land, a land where women could remove the hardship of pregnancy at their whim, a land where evil corporations are dismantled and given their due, a land where anyone can walk into any medical facility and demand treatment regardless of the means to pay. And leading them to their imagined promised land were a Noah of mixed blood, a man who positioned himself as the prophet of the new post-racial society he hinted was coming, a man who could simply will things into existence simply by speaking or reading the proper words. A huge part of leadership is certainly symbolic, with Winston Churchill being the most obvious example. Churchill understood the power of words and the imagery those words could create. But Churchill had credibility with the British people. He had a long record of public service, including a distinguished time as a war leader during World War I. And after serving as a respected cabinet member, he actually resigned his post in order to go to France and serve in the trenches among the men, putting himself in harm's way in order to be among the men he loved. And those men dearly loved him in return. To Barack Obama, hardship is when he can't see the words on his beloved teleprompter. He lacks the required credibility to lead simply because he's never done so, instead choosing to spend his life among the academic elites, praised by a mother who yearned to be one herself, while honoring the memory of a father who also failed to reach such heights. The White House staff is literally the first organization he's ever led in his entire life. Instead, his political career has been spent making backroom deals and casting votes out of political expediency. He was a legislator known for jumping out in front of parades almost as often as he voted present. The evidence of such an unimpressive legislative career is the mixed bag of legislation that he's rammed through in order to create his version of a cherished utopia on the shores of America. His speeches about both the stimulus package and his much-touted health care reform package were typically eloquent and overstated. He said all the right things, the very same words which had initially convinced so many to anoint him in the first place. Problem is, it eventually came time to perform, and his performance has been an abject failure. The stimulus package, which promised hundreds of billions towards shovel-ready projects, which would prevent unemployment from reaching 8%, instead turned out to be a pork-stuffed monstrosity filled with sham payouts and gifts to the unions, who are vital to his presidency. His even more highly touted health care reform package not only needed a sleazy backroom maneuver to pass, but has proven to be actually the opposite of what he promised, at least if you judge the tens of thousands of workers looking at the likelihood of losing their own coverage in direct contradiction to the grandiose promises President Obama read from his teleprompter. Just like the mythical Icarus, our own tragic hero is just now crashing to earth. Democratic-leaning pollster Public Policy Polling is now forced to admit that their savior is suffering huge declines in popularity, even in states so reliably blue that we often tag them with the moniker People's Republic of. The denizens of those states who have seemingly awoken from the deep slumber of 2008, no doubt due to their hopey-changey pills wearing off. Understanding that admitting there actually is a problem in the first step to recovery, I eagerly anticipate a renewal of sanity in this great nation of ours. I ask you to join me in praying, both for our nation and for its leadership. While we've already had one morning in America, who's to say the sun can't rise once again? But guys, I want to get back to talking about these, the stimulus package and the healthcare package in particular, because those have been of interest here in the last couple, in the past week. Two things of note. First of all, is that we saw millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars from the stimulus package not going to American companies, but to companies who do their jobs overseas. And then the other part, on the other hand, with the healthcare program, we have seen waivers this week. I believe 28 in total. We'll have to double check that. But waivers, grants given to other organizations from the healthcare bill. So now they don't have to participate.
Yeah, so like the unions who pushed for health care now are exempt from health care if they so choose?
Well, it was one thing to have, you know, obviously the executive and the speaker and her staff, which were also eliminated from participating in the health care bill. They've been granted a waiver out of originality. And now we have, well, McDonald's was granted one. Because they said that they couldn't provide health care insurance to their part-time employees.
A waiver from health care sounds like a gift. If the new health care bill was supposed to be wonderful, why are the waivers sounding like gifts?
Exactly. I mean, this was supposed to be the grand...
All are equal. Some are more equal than others.
Yes. You'll want to turn down your mic on that one. But essentially, that's what it's become, is that, you know, yeah, you have these big businesses, which Barack Obama and the Democrats have gone to Wall Street, and they say that we are against Wall Street, we're against big business, you know, we're for the small business guy, which is a load of gehosh. Because if you look at all the business PACs, whether they're small business, you got the Chamber of Commerce, you have BIPAC, they're getting in support of people who are pro-business. And they look at this administration and they know that they are not pro-business. And it's just astonishing that we have a president who can be so callous to not just what, you know, it's one thing to be callous to the poll, what the polls are saying. You know, Republicans and other pundits will say that, you know, the president's not paying attention to the polls. And, you know, they said that again about Bill Clinton. Well, he's not paying attention to the polls. Well, Democrats said that same thing about George W. Bush during the war. And, I mean, granted, the things were different. We had a war to take care of. We had a war to manage, and we had a war to win. And so to ignore the polls there, I understand. But, you know, we have a president here who isn't ignoring, you know, who is ignoring the will of the people, not just polls, but the very will of the people. And if he doesn't start listening there and soon, well, one, he's going to have a completely different Congress, a Republican-controlled Congress, and potentially a Republican-controlled Senate to deal with. And that happened to Bill Clinton in 1994. It could very well happen to Barack Obama. Now, will it save Barack Obama and get him a second term? Because he's going to have to move much more to the center than he currently is. Because he's.
Do you think he would do that? I mean, he's an ideologue, and I just.
No, he is an ideologue.
I don't know if he is really mentally capable of moving to the center.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that leads me to believe so. Rahm Emanuel is gone. You look like you're about to say something, Mike. You got something on your mind. We got 26 seconds to say it.
Let's carry this into another segment.
Well, it's a lot safer in the showers in D.C.
That's true. That's true, because Rambo is now raging in the cities of Chicago and the city of Chicago, where definitely the initial awakening of the dead occurred.
Now, I thought I heard that, you know, Rahm Emanuel is pursuing running for office in Chicago.
Mayor.
And he doesn't have the backing of his old boss.
I don't know about that. We're not going there. But this is something for discussion. We'll carry this on into another segment. Stay tuned. We'll be back on Gillespie on FTRradio.com here in just a moment. And welcome back to Gillespie. This is your host, Josh Gillespie. We are speaking with John Ziegler, who you may be familiar with of the How Obama Got Elected videos. Christy, tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, in 2008, John Ziegler wrote and directed and produced the documentary Blocking the Path to 9/11. We all, like you mentioned before, Josh, we know, I know him from How Obama Got Elected, and I think I also saw him get arrested once. So what I'd like to do is talk to John. Thank you so much for coming on with us. And tell us a little bit about Blocking the Path to 9/11. What motivated you to write and produce this documentary?
Well, during the original controversy surrounding the ABC docudrama, The Path to 9/11, as a radio talk show host in Los Angeles, I became very intimately familiar with the story even before it broke, because I happened to be part of a special screening at Disney, and I loved the film, but I also anticipated that it was going to cause a great deal of controversy, because I knew that it did something that was highly unusual in Hollywood and very dangerous, and that was that it told the truth, specifically about what happened with regard to 9/11, the real story leading up to 9/11. And so I got to know Cyrus Narasta, the filmmaker behind The Path to 9/11, and interviewed him several times during the controversy. And after it was all done, and after the film had been essentially edited and, for all intents and purposes, neutered and censored, I decided that this would be a heck of a documentary. I'd never made a documentary, feature documentary at that point. And Citizens United was a group that was willing to pay for the story to be made. And so I wrote and produced, directed, and actually voiced the ensuing documentary on a docudrama, Blocking the Path to 9/11, which people can still purchase at the website www.blockingthepath.com or on amazon.com.
Great. Now, tell us a little bit about some of the things that you expose in Blocking the Path to 9/11.
Well, the main thing that we do is we tell the entire story in context. And we tell the story of the making of the original film, The Path to 9/11. We tell the story of how the media did the bidding for former members of the Clinton administration to destroy its credibility. We reveal some of the inner workings of Disney, the Disney Corporation, during the making of the film and the aftermath during its controversy, and how and why Disney chose to edit the film and eventually censor it since it's never been seen again. And we also show clips of the film, the original film, that never aired, some of the key parts that were edited out and censored by the Disney Corporation in conjunction with ABC, all at the under pressure by the Clinton administration. So that was, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the film, and it's very comprehensive. It's a very startling story. It's upsetting, but it's also entertaining. And Cyrus Narasta, the filmmaker, does a great job of really kind of carrying the entire film, as obviously he's the star. He's a courageous guy, interesting fellow, and has gone on to do lots of other great things since the path to 9/11.
John, I know that no president ever wants to have any major terroristic, especially on our own land, on their watch. Unfortunately, that happened during President Bush's first term. But you know, we had, as you mentioned, you know, the path to it. You know, we had the bombing in 1993. We had the bombing of the USS Cole. Why are the Clintons trying to suppress this information?
Well, I mean, you've got to remember the climate of what was happening when this controversy first happened, which was the fifth anniversary of 9/11, which was 2006. Mm-hmm. At that point, Hillary Clinton was considered to be a frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination, if not the prohibitive frontrunner. And obviously, the Clinton administration's reputation on something as important as the war on terrorism was going to be incredibly important if Hillary was going to be considered to be the next president of the United States. And you know, the Clinton administration had basically gotten away with metaphorical murder, with the notion that somehow they really had no responsibility in this. When you consider that the first attack on the World Trade Center occurred in 1993, and the Clinton administration basically treated that as if it was a criminal matter and not part of a larger topic of terrorism against the United States, and allowed several other attacks to occur on foreign soil against the United States, where the American people really weren't all that keyed into it. The media pretty much ignored most of these things. And then obviously the last and maybe most dramatic being the attack on the USS Cole very late in the Clinton administration. So if it wasn't just an ego thing, this was clearly political because of the prospect of Hillary running for president in less than 2 years from the time of that controversy. And so, and also, you got to remember that Sandy Berger had already been, at this point, had already been apprehended for having stolen classified documents from the National Archives directly related to this issue.
That's right,
and
I forgot the
media,
about that.
And the media had ignored that, so this had the potential of bringing that back into its proper context. And of course, one of the most amazing elements of the entire controversy is that Sandy Berger was actually interviewed, as we document in my film Blocking the Path to 9/11, was actually interviewed on CNN without that issue ever being raised. So he was allowed to destroy the credibility of the path to 9/11 without Wolf Blitzer of CNN even mentioning the fact that, oh, by the way, you had been apprehended for having stolen classified documents related to this issue from the National Archives. So that's really kind of remarkable. I mean, it's more than remarkable. It's beyond appalling. So there was a lot going on into this, and that's why it makes such an interesting story for a documentary.
And it seems like the media, who should be always on the front lines of the First Amendment, have been quite complicit in covering up and suppressing the path to 9/11, and basically enabling the suppression of this. So when it's Bush's fault, it's like it's a free-for-all. But when it's Bill's fault, it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, there's a totally – I mean, I think everyone who follows these things knows that there's a total double standard in the news media, and it usually breaks down along political lines. There are certain people they like and certain people they don't, and they've always liked Bill Clinton. They certainly helped him through the impeachment process. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, our memories are short. You know, the media didn't tell that narrative as it was happening to the American people. So, you know, it's kind of an indictment of them as well. So for them to go back and look at the whole thing in context and blame Bill Clinton, I mean, that's kind of unrealistic to ask for something like that, because we know that's not going to happen, because that's just not the way the media works. The media doesn't really care about truth. They care about their own agendas, whether that be ratings or political in nature. But truth is really very, very low on their priority list.
John, so what is the next step? What can our listeners do to help you and Mark Tapson and Risa Kirkland, the people who are behind this, getting the path to 9/11 out there? What can our listeners do to help you guys out?
Well, I know that there's a petition that I'm sure Mark talked about to try to get the Disney to finally release the DVD and/or reshow the film. You know, we've got the 10th anniversary of 9/11 coming up next year. You know, originally the path to 9/11 was intended to be shown. At one point, they actually talked about showing it every year on 9/11. Certainly, every other year was more than realistic, and certainly every 5 years. I really think that when they made the path to 9/11 at Disney, they would have been stunned. That it would never air again, and certainly that no one was talking about airing it on the 10th anniversary. It's an incredibly important film. It's gripping. It's two nights, a 5-hour-plus miniseries where it tells the real. It's the only movie that tells the real story about what happened to lead the United States into the worst terrorist attack in its history, and it's incredibly important that we be reminded of this. I mean, we've heard many, many times the reason why there's so many Holocaust movies is that we need to make sure it never happens again, and that wasn't even an American atrocity.
Never forget. Yes, exactly. You have to remember. Now, John, have you professionally had any issues or threats levied against you for your involvement in blocking the path to 9/11?
Well, I certainly hasn't helped my career. I mean, in Hollywood, that's for sure. One of the things that we did do that did not make it directly into the film, although is referenced in the film and is a long story as to why that's the case, but I actually spoke with the guy at Disney whose idea the path 9/11 really was. And he's actually a very, very ardent liberal and Clinton supporter. And, you know, he basically revealed a lot about what was happening at Disney and some of the inside stuff there. But he was afraid to go on with us on camera. And I had recorded my conversation with him. And we played it for Cyrus, and Cyrus comments on it in the film, but for a variety of reasons, some political, some legal, we decided not to actually use that audio. But there's no question that he was frightened for his career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know Cyrus obviously received death threats, numerous death threats, and having his home address be put on the internet and all sorts of other things because of his work on the path to 9/11. But by the time my film came out, it was pretty much ignored by the news media, partially because Hillary had been defeated for the Democratic presidential nomination, and that's the way the media works these days. Is, you know, if there's nothing relevant about what's going to happen in the future, you know, that's directly in someone's face, they tend to not see it as relevant. So I personally have not received any threat, but certainly lots of other people related to this film have.
Well, John, I thank you for coming on onto the show. This has been kind of an eye-opening interview, and I want all of our listeners to check out blockingthepath.com to find out more about the documentary that John has put together. Find it on DVD, watch it, and educate yourself. This is an important matter, and we can't be having this stuff hidden. John, thanks for being on the show.
Yes, thanks, John.
Thank you.
All right, and that is that was John Ziegler. We'll be right back after these messages.
And welcome back to Gillespie. We are here talking with Mark Warner on the phone. Mark is doing some campaign work today, aren't you, Mark?
Yes, I am.
He is out busy, but he has taken some time. He's going to talk to us about the Smart Girl Summit. It was a couple of weeks ago. We already know that, but we weren't on the air last week. We ran a repeat. But I wanted to talk with Mark and just talk about our experience attending the Smart Girls Summit that was put on by Stacey Mott and Terry Kristoff and the rest of the Smart Girls, Smart Girl Nation. Mark, this was a pretty good event, wasn't it?
It was. It was a good event, even though it is election season. Well, I think they had close to 200 people there.
Yeah, a lot of in comparison to BlogCon, this is a good turnout. But you have a lot of bloggers at BlogCon. This was more of an activist training kind of activity, wasn't it?
Right. It was more activist training, how to do it correctly, not just hold up your Hitler signs and stuff like that.
Yeah, because you know we as Republicans, according to the One Nation crowd, we're all about Hitler signs.
Yeah, when they did it for 8 years under the Bush administration.
That's right, yeah.
Funny how they forget that stuff.
Oh, I mean, completely forget it. But, you know, hey, if the media didn't report it, it didn't happen, right?
Right.
Right.
Nothing happened.
Right.
So it was a good event. I was actually out there doing Hoosier Access stuff as well as FTR stuff, as well as my full-time job.
Your full-time job with Faulkner Strategies with Plug'em, you know. Yeah. You need direct mail, talk to Mark at Faulkner Strategies.
We were one of the sponsors for it, so I was running our booth, doing some FTR stuff, doing some Hoosier Access stuff, so I was busy.
Yeah.
I was busy.
Well, the ladies were quite pleased that there was such a strong male turnout to support them. I mean, this was a tremendous event put on by the Smart Girls. Michelle Bachmann highlighted one evening of speaking, and then they had other speakers like Liz Cheney and SC Cup. And I mean, just a whole host of others. In fact, Kristen Ludhart with the Prosper Group, from here in town, was also a presenter, talking about, what they do with, kind of an online campaign and pushing that and, the digital kind of campaign.
Right.
So
she was on the digital side of stuff. And she did a really good job. Her, Katie Harbath, she works for the NRSC. There's a couple other people in there talking about that. So they did a really good job, and a lot of good people were paying attention in there and asking questions afterwards. And I think that's what this whole thing was about, was to get people informed on, you know, what people are doing out there to help candidates. And, you know, a lot of them were Tea Party members that were there. They're pretty much Republicans, but when it comes to the Tea Party, they, you know, Republicans and their consultants are bad news and blah, blah, blah. But I think it helped that there was some high-profile consultants out there that were saying, hey, you know, we work with other people as well. And this is what to help.
Yeah.
People get elected. And I think that really drew the gap in between some Republicans and some Tea Party members.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember having a conversation.
I think it helped.
Well, again, you know, it was a Smart Girl Summit, so, you know, there were Elizabeth Blackney, Media Lizzie was there, so was Dr. Melissa Clothier, Melissa Tweets, we've had her on before with Liberty Pundits as well. And I was talking with her and with Rebecca Wales, also Smart Girl Politics, just about the idea of women ascending into leadership, especially on the Republican side. You know, we have Speaker Pelosi leading the Democrats, and I asked Rebecca and I asked Melissa, I was like, when is this going to happen with on the Republican side? Are we going to see it with Michelle Bachmann? Are we going to see it with Marsha Blackburn? And they actually said it would probably happen with Marsha Blackburn. She may be the one to ascend to leadership because Michelle, she's been one to rock the boat. She's been one to challenge the party. And not that that doesn't make her qualified for leadership, because Marsha Blackburn has definitely been a leader on the Hill, and I know she's been willing to take her own stances. But I think it was more seemed as that, you know, Marsha is someone who
is... She doesn't buck the party as much as...
Well, it was. I don't think it was necessarily about not bucking the party, but it was someone who is probably easier to work with,
right?
And Congresswoman Bachmann, she is definitely a firecracker and someone who can get an entire, all the Republican side energized. She can get the Tea Party energized, and so she's definitely a leader in her own right. Not to take anything away from Congresswoman Bachmann, but. It's just that Marsha might be someone who you go to push something through. Who is someone you can basically work with a lot easier. So
yeah, she can take the idea to the room and put a plan together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a fan of Michelle Bachmann, but I'm a huge fan of Marsha Blackburn. Marsha first came into Congress in 2003, and she was a freshman on the Government Reform Committee when I still worked in D.C., and she's just tremendous. She is a joy to work with and a hard worker. So I know that she has a lot of that going for her, especially when you're working on the Hill and working with leadership. But
right.
The other thing that was being talked about was the next Smart Girl Summit. Because the smart girls, you know, it takes a while to plan something like this.
It does. And they're already starting to plan next year. I know that much. It was funny how this happened. Myself, Thomas LeDuc, and Terry Kristoff were sitting out in one of the hallways there talking, and Tom's like, have you thought about where you're going to have it next year? And I said, I think you should have it in Indianapolis. And Duke goes, you know, that's a great idea. And
Wait a minute. Terry brought that up, or do you brought that up?
No, I did.
Oh, okay.
I did.
Yes.
And Duke was like, that's a great idea. And Terry's like, well, what does Indianapolis have to offer? Because when people think about Indy, they just, you know, they think of cornfields. I'm like, no, that's up north by Kokomo. Here's, you know, missing the point here.
Yeah.
Indianapolis is a good city. We have a lot of things to offer downtown. And so I brought that up, and actually I sent her an email this past week. About the convention center and all the hotels and who to contact where and who. And so I sent that email out, and hopefully that gets some groundwork laid. And she did respond back and saying, you know, our members are important, so we're going to do a quick survey on where they would like to have it and what their thoughts are. So we'll know something probably soon, but I would like to see it come to Indianapolis. I really would. I really would. And I know you talked to her about it, and I know April talked to her about it, which I've been harassing April all day on Twitter. That's been kind of fun.
It's always fun to harass her.
But, yeah, it is fun to harass her. And I'm not understanding why she doesn't like the Beatles or Star Wars, but that's for a different conversation.
It is.
But she sent me some information as well to kind of help with the talking points on getting – than Mike, to decide.
Mike's got a question for you.
Well, I was just going to say, it's not like Indianapolis is not a stranger to holding conventions on a political side. After all, we did hold the YR National Convention just last year.
And if there's no lockout, I mean, we will have the Super Bowl. And that's an if, big if and, right now.
Well, we've held FFA National Convention for how many years?
That's
until
true.
Now it's in this scheme where it
goes back and forth.
Back and forth here in Louisville.
Yeah.
We used to hold the Performance Racing Industry Convention every winter here until they moved to Orlando, Florida, because Orlando offered them a larger convention center.
Which I bet they wish they had access to our new one now.
Well, I think they might come back in a few years.
It wouldn't surprise me. But see, these are the things that we can offer to Terry and to Stacy and the rest of the Smart Girl group.
Right. There's actually one of the leaders, one of the girls on the leadership team, one of the, I think her name is Wendy. She actually owns her own event planning thing. And when I mentioned Indianapolis, she's like, oh, I love planning events in Indianapolis. It's so easy and it's so nice and everything is right there.
It is.
I'm like, yeah, you just keep talking like that, please.
It is. And everything is in walking distance. You know, if you want if you want to go down to Scotty's Brew House where they have, how many beers on tap and are available, you know, you can go down and get an easy drink.
It's even a Cubs bar.
Yeah, it's even a Cubs bar.
And Scotty's, the thing with Scotty's Brew House is when there's a convention held, he promotes his stuff to that convention and says, hey, come down here. We'll be your official convention place to eat and drink.
Yeah, so check out Scotty's Brew House, everybody. You can find him at Brew House on Twitter. But, yeah, so Indianapolis offers quite a bit. And, frankly, Mark, I think we should start the hashtag SGS Indy. And
you know, that's not a bad idea.
That isn't a bad idea. And, you know, we're not as men trying to impose our will upon these women. No, we're just giving them opportunities to come to a wonderful city like Indianapolis.
And instead of a ghetto like D.C.
No, we were in Crystal City. And being a mile away from the metro. And mind you, you're going to get cheaper hotel rates here in Indianapolis than you will in a place like D.C. or maybe even St. Louis, because I know Terry said that they're looking at St. Louis. But either way, you know, we want to encourage the Smart Girls to come to Indianapolis next year. You know, hopefully we'll have Congresswoman Jackie Walorski who can come speak to them. We have Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman. We have female leaders in our own right here in this state.
Who by then could be governor candidate.
She probably will be a governor candidate at that time. But anyway, Mark, thanks for coming on to the show. I know you got to get back to doing your campaign work, but we thank you for your time, and we'll be talking to you again. And I know you'll be back full time on the show once the election ends.
Is it November 3rd yet?
Yeah, tell me about it. Mark, thanks for being on, and we'll be right back to Gillespie here on FTRradio.com. SGS Indy, everyone. SGS Indy. And welcome back to Gillespie. We're bringing back an old segment of ours. It's typically called Tuesday Evening Stupid, but we're rebranding it. You know, we wanted it to be an award-winning segment, but it wasn't. So I'm hoping the new title, which Mike, our engineer, came up with a clever title. Mike, what is the name of our new segment?
Tomorrow is Wednesday, then it's Thursday, then it's Friday. WTF.
Or
we all know what WTF means.
It's WTF Tuesdays. That is a new one. So you can either call it Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or what the frick, whatever. We don't go that far on the show. I'm just saying. But it is what the F Tuesdays here on Gillespie.
Or just WTFT.
WTF Tuesdays.
WTFT Radio.
Yeah, we're not that. But we're going to talk about two things, because while we were at the Smart Girls Summit, the NRA came out with three endorsements two endorsements here in Indiana that floored those of us.
Said WTF.
Yes, we did. And I can tell you that when I got the text from Abdul, local radio show host here in town, he texted me, said that Brad Ellsworth, who was running against Dan Coats, got the endorsement of the NRA. And I texted him back, and I said, you know, not surprising. Not surprising. You know, Brad Ellsworth, he, you know, you look at his record in Congress and you compare that to Dan Coats' record in Congress. I wasn't necessarily surprised there. But I missed his second text. But then I got the information later when someone came in the room and said that Joe Donnelly had been given the NRA endorsement over Jackie Walorski.
What the?
Exactly. Jackie Walorski. You may remember Jackie. She was on our very first show. Hopefully we can have her on before before the general. But Jackie is, she carries a gun with her everywhere.
In fact, on the old Hoosier Access radio show, mm-hmm. she was on one time and she had talked about a new state house security mandate that they start when they put in metal detectors and started, you know, not allowing firearms on the state in the state house
she
property.
She protected lawmakers and she made sure that they got to carry if they had them.
Because she wanted to keep carrying.
Absolutely. And here's the other thing that I like about Jackie. Jackie supports the Castle Doctrine. She was one of the state representatives who pushed for the Castle Doctrine to be passed. And what the Castle Doctrine does is basically is that wherever you are, it's basically like your home. You are allowed to defend your space. And so if you have a gun on you, you can defend yourself. It is the Castle Doctrine. If you're in your home, if you're in your car, Mike is pulling out his Glock right now just to prove that this house is safe.
Okay, now, what about for places like, say, at the hospital, and it says no weapons?
It's private property. They are entitled to whatever policy they
exactly.
feel like.
That's private property. But, I mean, you know, essentially what we're talking about here is public space.
Well, the thing about the Castle Doctrine, what it does, for one thing, it partially immunizes you. Okay, say if someone were to break into our studio as we're all sitting here. Okay, I pull out my Glock and I pop them a couple times.
Because Mike would do that.
Yes, I would. And the person, I don't kill him. I just wound him really bad. Okay, he
so
goes.
So you aim for the kneecap.
Well, I just aim for whatever. But
the kneecap and the shoulder.
But that person, not only would I be, I would not be criminally held liable. I would also not be civilly liable because, the prosecutor can't prosecute, but he could go find an ambulance chaser and sue you for it. Well, under the Castle Doctrine, you cannot be sued or prosecuted if you defend your home using a firearm.
Well, one of the funny things here is that. I was talking to another fellow, Republican, who's in a position, to kind of put some perspective on these kinds of things. And frankly, it wasn't enough perspective for me, but I understood what he was talking about. He said that, the NRA, and he wasn't, in a sense, he was sort of defending the NRA, but not really because he's a gun, gun carrier too, and was surprised at the endorsements. But he said, what the NRA is doing here is that they're a single issue group. And so they look at the records and they vote on the issue. They don't look at anything else. They don't see where, the outcome, like if a Democrat majority is, going to kill government or gun legislation, what they're looking at is does this Democrat or does this Republican support gun legislation? And I thought about that. I was like, okay, that made sense initially. And then it was, wait a minute, what about all these other single issue groups? Right to Life? They're not coming out and looking at a voting record. Well, they are, but they're also looking at the reality of whether that their particular issue is going to get passed in a particular kind of legislature. And pro-gun legislation, and Mike, you know this, pro-gun legislation will not pass in a Democrat-controlled Congress.
Absolutely.
Well, this isn't the first WTF for the NRA.
No, it isn't.
We have, the Disclose Act.
Well, let's get back to that.
Hold on. Yes, we do have the Disclose Act. We also have them publicly saying that they would support Harry Reid, although I think they've kind of backed out on that.
Well, the thing that I'm starting to – the NRA has been infiltrated.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know about infiltrated, but I believe that part of this NRA bit with endorsing these folks is a little quid pro quo.
I don't know. It might be, the new guy who's taken over, Christopher Cox, he's getting a lot of heat, especially from a lot of gun owners.
He's also getting a lot of canceled subscriptions, too.
Not only that, I'm hearing a lot more NRA is irrelevant. And I started the hashtag on Twitter. I want everyone to start picking this up. WTFNRA. Because that was my response. And then I heard that they supported Baron Hill over Todd Young, but they gave Todd Young an AQ rating, which is almost like giving him an endorsement.
But he's never served in office.
He's never served in office, but he's a Marine. But they did not give Jackie an AQ rating. I think there's a part of me that thinks this goes back to a press release that Jackie had released back in the primary, and the NRA slammed her for it. It was petty. I think this is petty payback to Jackie. And then they also supported Trent Van Haften, the Democrat running in the 8th Congressional District, formerly the Bloody 8th, who's running against Larry Bouchon, who, if you check out on Hoosier Access, has been endorsed by Congressman Kevin McCarthy, who is the House Deputy Whip. He wrote a great post on Hoosier Access supporting Dr. Larry Bouchon and Todd Young. But it blows my mind that the NRA is quickly becoming irrelevant, but probably much to the glee of the Gun Owners Association.
Gun Owners of America.
Gun Owners of America. Excuse me. Yes. You can tell I don't belong
there's
to either.
There's GOA, Second Amendment Patriots. There's a few other groups out there, but GOA came out with their ratings, and needless to say, Ellsworth, they look at the total picture.
Exactly, and that's what you need to do.
Oh, they use common sense.
Well, they look at the total picture as in, you know, the D behind their name knocks them down at least two notches.
Well, because they know exactly, even if they're a supporter of gun rights, that, you know, their support is going to get them nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, if they're in the majority, yeah, they'll say, yeah, I support firearms rights, but, you know, it's like yelling in an empty room.
Okay, I want to transition here real quick, because we had some good off-air conversation and we're running out of time. But I want to bring up congressional candidate, and I believe it's Virginia's first congressional district.
Do you know offhand where that covers?
I don't.
Okay.
But her name is Crystal Ball. I kid you not. And I'm sure you may, if you've been watching Fox News this past week, you might have heard of her. If you read any of the blogs out there, like Wonkette, which is a liberal-leaning blog, yes, but... They released the picture. There are so-called racy pictures of Miss Ball at a Christmas party 6 years ago. She's 28 years old now. 28 years old now, but she was 22 when this happened. And she is not scantily clad, but she's wearing some
midriff action there.
Midriff action, yeah. Christy's looking at this with me, but some of these pictures involve. Oh, gosh. It's really tough to explain, but...
You just got to go and look for
yourself.
It's
a penis nose is what it is.
Okay, thank you, Christy. Yes, is what it is. A guy who's trying to look like Rudolph, and he has a red...
Penis nose.
Yes. And her she's got her hands wrapped around that. And, of course, the other pictures of her, you know, she is rightfully, I guess, in a sense, outraged. But the fact is that these pictures were found on Facebook.
Were they? But I don't know. Was it her Facebook or somebody else's Facebook? Because you can't control what other people put up.
You can untag. You can untag yourself.
You can't untag yourself,
and
your image is still there.
Yes, but that's a lot harder to find you. And she comes out and she says that these are sexist, and of course that these are the fault of the Republican, and the Republican is completely denying it. Now the Republican is
fault of the Republicans.
Not that the pictures are sexist, but making an issue out of the pictures.
All I'm saying is that even the Wonkette. One of the pictures is of this guy with the nose and the antlers. He has this chain around his neck. He's leashed. And Miss Ball has the chain going through her mouth. She's biting on it, you know, like
giving her teeth
and giving you some crazy eyes. But Wonkette, the liberal Wonkette, says if anything. This last picture is sexist. Men are not animals. You can simply exploit for your own enjoyment at holiday parties. And she is right. I am not to be exploited. How do you feel
Someone
about this?
Forgot to explain
I think this
that
guy
to
looks
our,
absolutely miserable. You know, she's strapped this nose on him.
How much alcohol?
Exactly, alcohol. But there's nothing to say that she strapped the nose. Now, this guy, this idiot, probably could have came to this event by himself, or it could be her husband. I'm not sure. But apparently she attended this event with her husband, mm-hmm. she claims. But yes, this picture where she is standing next to her friend, just, I'm not even going to explain that one. That one's kind of gross too. Go to wonkette.com if you really want to see these. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe that is her husband because she's leading him up the stairs
she's
in this
him,
particular
she's got him on a chain.
Leash. Yes. Yeah. Like he's an animal.
Uh-oh. Christy's getting ideas for home.
I'm 40. I don't need any ideas.
So okay, anyway.
You know what? I think, what are we going, where are we going with this?
Because, I'm just saying, WTF.
I know. I don't think it's a big deal. I think for us to make big deals out of people's photos now, we just have to accept what kind of world we live in. Everyone's got a camera, you know, in their pocket, in their cell phone.
In a sense, Chris Zilliza of The Fix on the Washington Post, and I'm going to close on this, says the same thing. He's like, on Facebook, the younger candidates, the kids who are in college, they have these kinds of pictures online, and they're too stupid to take it off right now, but maybe they will in the future if they run for office. Who knows? But we'll probably be seeing a lot more of this in the future.
And even if they don't have them posted, other people will be like, ooh, they're getting in the limelight.
In other words, if you want to ever run for political office, don't get into that kind of situation.
No, just if you want to run for political office, you must live in a closet, a literal closet.
Well, all I know is I do aspire to run for office someday, and I do care about where my picture is taken. Well, that's it for tonight's show. Thank you for tuning in for Gillespie. Stay tuned for the Aaron Proctor Show, followed by Duke Over America. The Jenny Erickson Show is on at 10 p.m., followed by Michael Fidenza, the Armchair Energist. Thanks for tuning in tonight, guys. We'll see you next week.